Welcome to One True Podcast. I'm Mark Chirino.
And I'm Michael Von Cannon.
In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues a new feature at One True Podcast where during 2024, we are celebrating the centenary of the Paris in Our Time by reading the 18 sketches all together. And Michael, today's show, we focus on chapter 2. But before we do, let's listen to the master, Stacy Keach, in the Simon & Schuster audio version of Chapter 2 of In Our Time.
Chapter 2. The first matador got the horn through his sword hand, and the crowd hooted him. The second matador slipped, and the bull caught him through the belly, and he hung on to the horn with one hand and held the other tight against the place. And the bull rammed him wham against the wall, and the horn came out, and he lay in the sand and then got up like a crazy drunk and tried to slug the men carrying him away and yelled for his sword, but he fainted. The kid came out and had to kill 5 bulls, because you can't have more than 3 matadors, and the last bull, he was so tired he couldn't get the sword in. He couldn't hardly lift his arm. He tried 5 times, and the crowd was quiet, because it was a good bull, and it looked like him or the bull, and then he finally made it. He sat down in the sand and puked, and they held a cape over him while the crowd hollered and threw things down into the bull ring.
In the uppercase In Our Time in 1925, Chapter 2 is not Chapter 2, is it?
No, it's not. What we are reading at this point appears much later.
You'll find it wedged in between The Revolutionist and Mr. and Mrs. Elliot as Chapter 9. And you were talking, Michael, last episode about Hemingway's design and his sequencing and how he envisioned the interchapters coordinating with the fuller stories. But today we have a much different concern, and that is Hemingway's, really his first effort at writing about bullfights, which would become one of his great themes. So how does he approach this great theme of his career and of his life? What should we notice, Michael?
I think a few things that we should notice, and then maybe at a certain point we'll jump into some of the kind of the biographical details. What's going on with Hemingway at this point in 1924 when it's published, but certainly in 1923 and some of the moments that inspire it. But what we can really notice is that it's a series of 3 different images about bullfighters, a triptych of sorts, and that Hemingway is certainly interested in the violence that's occurring in the bullring. It's as if he has never seen this level of violence kind of manifest before. And he's also interested in not just the way they handle themselves, their reactions. He's also interested in how the audience responds. So we have, from the beginning, the crowd hooting. We have later on, and this is the way the vignette ends, so kind of bookending it in a sense, is that the crowd is hollering and throwing things down into the bullring.
I am thinking about Hemingway's description of bullfighting in Death in the Afternoon, which was 1932. He comes out and says what attracted bullfighting to him, why he was interested in it. And he was saying, since the war's over, the only place where you could go witness violence close, firsthand, is the bullring. And so not only do you get to witness the violence where you can witness the performance of the matador, but as you're saying, Michael, you could also see how all the human beings reacted, how the crowd reacted. And do you remember that little section at the end of Death in the Afternoon? I think it's called Some Reactions, where he actually does a little miniature case study of all the people that he ever brought to bullfights and how they reacted, what bothered them, what excited them, how this proximity to violence changed their emotions. What a writerly experiment to make.
He is the spectator. He's watching this performance as a work of art, trying to understand what makes it a work of art, not a sport. And we'll get to that particular piece that's in the Toronto Star Weekly, where he discusses it as an artwork, as tragedy, and not as sport. But he's also a spectator in the sense that you can just see him looking around at other people,
yes,
seeing how they are reacting. And he even begins Death in the Afternoon, doesn't he, where he's talking about how other people, they get sick, or they develop a kind of moral superiority.
Yeah, and they turn away, right? They turn away at the moment. I mean, in fact, the sun also rises. Everybody always talks about the great scenes in Pamplona, and they are great scenes, but there's an enormous emphasis of how is Robert Cohn going to react to the bullfight? How is Brett Ashley going to react to the bullfight? In fact, it's conspicuous that Jake spends as much time worrying about how Robert and Brett react and what freaks them out or what they respond to than the bullfight itself. But that's consistent with Hemingway's interest.
It is. And before we get too far into this one, I do want to say, just for those listening in, we're talking about Death in the Afternoon. That's 1932. We're exploring this particular series of vignettes, which is 1924.
Right.
How are these two pieces kind of held together in time? And I did want to go back to Hemingway's letter to Bill Horn, which is actually July 1923. So right in the period where he is going to bullfights for the first time. And he says something that you said about kind of that one of the famous moments in Death in the Afternoon, where he's talking about bullfights and he says, it's just like having a ringside seat at the war with nothing going to happen to you.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But it leads me to a question that maybe we can use as the jumping off point to explore this vignette a little bit more and what's going on biographically and historically. And that's this. How do you make sense of it after the first vignette? The first vignette, we are outside of this battlefield. We're heading toward the battlefield, and now we are in a completely different space. Maybe we're in a different time. How are these two held together, or are they not held together? Where do you see connection going on?
I love how, if we're going to put substance into how Hemingway sequences these stories, to have a bullfighting sketch come right after the Battle of the Champagne, that is important. And it's worth noting that chapter 2 is about a million times more violent than chapter 1, which is really ironic given that you have one of the most savage, bloody battles in France in World War I, and you have a bullfighting, which is entertainment, ostensibly. And yet, chapter 2, we have these hellacious injuries, puking, fainting, goring, crowd, mob, mob mentality. And so, in a weird way, chapter 2 is the chaos.
Chapter 2 is finally arriving at the front lines of sorts, right? And to go back to Death in the Afternoon or that letter, the war imagery of the bull ring shows up when you start to put these two together. I would also say this is one of the bullfighters, and then he got up like crazy drunk and tried to slug the men, carrying him away. And so we also have that idea of being drunk or the craziness of drunkenness, and that as a topic holds these two together in a kind of tension.
And going back to what you were saying about the letter that he wrote to Horn, he says, so there's this phrase in chapter 2 where he says, the kid came out and had to kill 5 bulls because you can't have more than 3 matadors. Well, that's a rule in bullfighting that's probably been, you know, Michael, you and I are not bullfighting aficionados, mm-hmm. but that's a rule that is part of bullfighting tradition, probably for decades or centuries. Well, war doesn't have those kinds of rules. That's kind of what Hemingway was getting at. Hemingway in Death in the Afternoon talks about the difference between a boxing match and a street fight. A boxing match has timed, you know, you can't hit below the belt, certain rules, but a street fight, anything goes. Well, the difference between war and bullfighting is like an attenuated or sort of organized form of that kind of violence that you would get in warfare. Remember in chapter one, we were talking about the killing came suddenly and unreasonably. Not so in bullfighting. It's death in the afternoon. It happens at a particular time. We have the first matador, the second matador, the kid. And so it's much more structured.
That's a really good point.
I remember in chapter one, we were talking about how the subject changes in the first few sentences. Well, you know, the first matador got the horn through his sword hand. The second matador slipped and the bull caught him through the belly. And the kid came out. And so it's really the kid. Now, is this the kind of presentation where Hemingway is thrusting you into the scene? Are we closer to the kid, or are we closer to the narrator who is telling the story? Where are we as readers when it comes to sort of our sympathy or our interest?
I'm with the kid a little bit, just because there are so many sentences about him. He's also the one not referred to as the first matador or the second matador, or he's not the third matador.
He's not the third matador, no.
He's the kid. And there are the first and second matador have one sentence each, I think. And the second sentence is a pretty long sentence. But the kid has, I think, three or four different sentences. And by the end of it, you're there with him, and he's in the sand, and he's puking. And I think you feel a certain kind of emotion for him that, or at least I do, that I don't necessarily feel, even though I'm seeing the violence going on with the others, that I don't necessarily feel in the same way with the others.
Typically, you expect Hemingway to name the bullfighters. I think that's what he does throughout his career. And he would even do it in our time. He would name the particular bullfighters. The kid is sort of implying to me that the person telling the story might sort of be breathlessly recounting something that he saw, maybe not knowing all that much about bullfighting, maybe passing this on quickly or something like that. It might not be told with a kind of technical detail that Hemingway would later do it in The Sun Also Rises, in Death in the Afternoon, in The Dangerous Summer, where Hemingway really had a kind of a precise eye towards the technique of bullfighting. This is more like the spectacle of it, and it's all compressed into just one paragraph.
Is it simply being observed by an individual who wants to be an aficionado, who is intrigued by bullfighting, who wants to gain that kind of knowledge and aficion, but is kind of a novice at this point? Maybe. You know, what we do know is that it kind of didn't take Hemingway long. You were talking about the rules of bullfighting. And here he's kind of talking about them, but he's not teaching us the rules of bullfighting, but it didn't take him long, like in the Toronto Star Weekly article. That's bullfighting, a tragedy. Bullfighting is not a sport. It is a tragedy, which appeared on the 20th of October in 1923. And then he wrote one the week later, which was on Pamplona. It was about Pamplona. And in those articles, he's really... He's only been at this for a few months now. It's since, I think, his first bullfight. The great scholar, especially Hemingway and bullfighting scholar, Miriam Mendel, kind of pins it down to the 27th of May, I think. May 27th, 1923 was his first.
So, Michael, you have to walk us through this, because he's actually, he wrote this before that.
So he sees his first bullfight on May 27th. In June, he is with Robert McAlmon, and they meet up with Bill Bird. Mm. They see various bullfights, and he writes that first article about that experience. So bullfighting's not a sport, yeah. It's a tragedy. And he's going to talk us through what the picador stage of bullfighting means, what the muleta's all about, what that final stage of kind of bringing about the death of the bull is. And he's starting to define his terms like he's going to define in the actual kind of the glossary at the end of yes. Death in the Afternoon. He's already starting all of that. But you don't have that. You don't have that kind of work here quite yet. And what's interesting, like you're saying, is, of course, this is the bullfighting vignette that appears in the little review, that Exiles number in spring of 23 prior to his visit to Spain. So how did that come about? And how did it come about that he's talking about Spain before he actually travels to Spain in late May and into June with McAlmon and Bird? Well, what we know is that he's been hearing about Spain from Gertrude Stein, and maybe most importantly in terms of this vignette, he's been hearing about it from his friend, the painter, the artist Mike Strader. The idea is that he's been having conversations about bullfighting with Strader, and one of those conversations kind of makes its way into this vignette. It's kind of an eyewitness account, but it's actually not Hemingway's own eyewitness account.
So it's almost like a reported monologue. I mean, you can see this could be an excited account from Strader that Hemingway compresses into one paragraph. In fact, it's one of the things that makes it, that we can argue for it being a monologue, is there are moments of colloquial speech and where the grammar is kind of sloppy, right? Where he says he couldn't hardly lift his arm. Is this something that somebody might say in a moment of excitement, but not that you would write if you're writing a chapter in a literary short story? It looked like him or the bull, and then he finally made it. I understand what he means, I think, but if you had another chance at writing it, you could be a lot more precise. But I don't think that's what Hemingway was going for. He was going for the rush of excitement in the description.
There are those moments where it's pretty ambiguous and you're wondering, is that on purpose? I'd like to add another kind of stylistic feature here, and that's sure. There's a lot of, there's an onomatopoetic element to it.
Yeah.
There are the hoots, wham.
Rammed him wham.
The bull rammed him wham against the wall. It doesn't equate to, but it does suggest that this comes from something that's kind of conveyed through dialogue, or at least it has that feature to it. It sounds like something that's spoken.
Yeah. In fact, if you think about any time we talk about Hemingway style on One True Podcast, all of our guests tend to argue against that stereotype that Hemingway is like terse, short sentences. Look at this sentence. Like, look at the second sentence that's describing the second matador. It's enormous. It's a run-on. I mean, it's a run-on sentence, right? Mm-hmm. And he hung on to the horn with one hand and held the other tight against the place. What the heck does that mean? Against the place, right?
I paused there for a while. Well, what is the place?
So this is exactly what you said, the last point you made, which is like, if it's vague, it's intentionally vague because it captures the carelessness of telling a story excitedly or telling it quickly. Tight against the place, and the bull rammed him wham against the wall, and the horn came out, right? And then got up like crazy drunk, right? Got up like crazy drunk. So it does capture it, but what you would think of as being Hemingway-esque, this is chapter two, is not. Stylistically, syntactically, what Hemingway is, stereotyped as.
There's something that's energetic, almost frantic about the way that that particular sentence is being conveyed here. You know, it's someone who's excited about what they're seeing and they want to communicate it as quickly as they can, trying not to leave out details. But also maybe, like we were saying a few minutes ago, is this someone who knows everything that they're talking about, who's able to, as Hemingway wanted to every year that he would go back, yeah, to be able to see every single detail? Is it someone who knows them? Is it someone who doesn't, but who's trying? Or is it someone who has that kind of expertise, but is conveying it to someone who's a narrator who's a bit more of a novice than the person who initially saw it?
When he says, the kid came out and had to kill five bulls because you can't have more than three matadors, that's exposition, right? That's, you can't have more. He's explaining a very basic rule of bullfighting that he's proud to know, but you probably don't know. It's like, you don't understand that that's the rule. You can't have it. And that's something that would have delighted Hemingway to have informed the reader.
If you go back and look at those Toronto Star Weekly articles, it is full of that. He does delight in having some kind of information.
Hemsplaining.
That, that other people don't, and that I think he loved being able to enter into this this kind of, what did Bill Bird call it? A kind of secret society, I think he referred to it. Like, I mean, it was part of this kind of secret society.
Like Jake and Montoya.
Of bullfighting. He wanted to let you know what he discovered.
This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit hemingwaysociety.org/journals. One True Podcast is proud to announce that this In Our Time episode is sponsored by Simon & Schuster Audio, which provided Stacy Keach's beautiful introduction to today's show. The Simon & Schuster Audio collection is an absolute treasure. Check out their entire Hemingway collection of audiobooks, including Stacy Keach's epic performance of all of Hemingway's short stories, collected in the Unabridged Short Stories Gift Edition. Michael, the entire Hemingway catalog or selected titles are available for download or on CD, including the legendary Donald Sutherland reading The Old Man and the Sea, John Slattery from Mad Men performing A Farewell to Arms, the late William Hurt's brilliant take on The Sun Also Rises, and others.
Absolutely. In fact, I just spent a long car ride across Florida listening to Campbell Scott's reading of For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it was great company.
Visit the Hemingway page at HemingwayAudiobooks.com to order Hemingway audiobooks from our friends at Simon & Schuster Audio. Michael, I think another aspect of this chapter two that is fascinating to me is the way that Hemingway considers the crowd. And you pointed out, we start the sketch with the crowd hooted the first matador out, and then we end with the crowd hollered. And, you know, he tried five times and the crowd was quiet because it was a good bull, and it looked like him or the bull, and then he finally made it. So he pleases the crowd. Are we to imagine he pleased the crowd? Just like with chapter one, we end in a sense with more questions than we started with, because the crowd hollered and threw things down into the bull ring. And that's how we end the story. So hollering and throwing things down into the bull ring, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, that's a mysterious moment. And I think it's amazing for a number of reasons. One, it's kind of prophetic in the sense that, later on in July, I think it was, Hemingway's going to see Maera fight, and Maera sprains his wrist, and Maera's going to try to kill a bull. Hemingway talks about this in that second piece that I was referencing, the one in the Toronto Star Weekly from October 27th about Pamplona in July, where he's like lifting the sword with his left hand and placing it in his right hand. He tries again and again to make these moves and to kill the bull, and he just can't because of how injured his wrist is. Obviously, this piece is not about that, but it happens enough in bullfighting that you see this, and you can just see that the audience is on the edge of their seat waiting for what's going to happen. And so I love that moment that the crowd was quiet because it was a good bull. And so we also see, like you said, you can't have more than three matadors. Well, we also have somebody who's discerning, or who thinks they know enough about bullfighting to know what a good bull is and what a bad bull is, right? And what a good bull is versus a great bull, right? They seem to have a sense of these classifications. And there is so much ambiguity. Is it needless around? They threw things down into the bull ring. You and I were talking about it before we started rolling. In Death in the Afternoon, they're throwing seat cushions down. Hemingway can be specific about this, about what audiences are throwing, but he's not going to do that. I want to think that the audience is like, this guy finally made it. He finally did it.
He saved the day, right?
He persisted through this all. He might be sick to his stomach right now, but he did it.
You know, Hemingway's never shy to talk about how certain bullfighting crowds are not appreciative, or they're easily duped by some fraudulent matador, and the true artist is not appreciated. And that also has a clear parallel in terms of art, where Hemingway could see that writers might make the same trickery, and an undiscerning audience would also be taken in by that. You know, I also want to tie this, Michael, just for a second, back to chapter one, where we were talking about to what extent is the narrator a participant in the drunkenness on the way to the champagne. Well, you might ask the same question. The narrator is talking about the crowd. And let's say this is something that Mike Strader told Hemingway. Well, was Mike hooting and hollering? Was he throwing stuff? Was he quiet? And if not, wouldn't he also include himself in that? Hemingway's just in the first two sketches only, he's already setting up the narrator it's a very curious performance in both vignettes.
For a young Hemingway who's now, he's talking to someone about bullfights, he's just about to go see bullfights, I don't know, I might be interested in what the audience is doing, how they are responding. Do you think Hemingway is thinking about that kind of right off the bat as the audience, that sometimes they're just dead wrong. Yeah. They don't see what's right in front of their eyes. The true bullfighter gets ridiculed. The guy who's full of trickery gets praise. Do you think he sees that at the beginning like this? Or do you think he's thinking as someone who's just coming to this world of bullfighting, hey, I need to get a sense of what it's about, how people react to it, how I should react to it? Do you think he's like looking at the audience to like gauge, when should I hoot? When should I holler?
Yeah, right.
Is there some of that to it too?
The answer to your awesome question is, I want to like table that to see, because we're going to be looking at a bunch of bullfighting stuff in
this
this particular vignette. I don't get that. What I get is we have one guy with a horn through his hand. We have another one, a horn through his belly. So you're having these enormous, really significant injuries, and the crowd is like, entertain us. we are here for a good bullfight. This other, so the three matadors are sacrificing their bodies, and we don't know how badly the first and second one got injured. In fact, we don't even know how badly the third ended up. It looks like to an inch of his life, he sacrificed himself for this performance. And the crowd, okay, we're finally pleased, or no, you didn't do it well enough, whatever. It's so ambiguous. This guy is puking, and he's, you know, they can't even, they don't even want him to be seen. And so I think what Hemingway is probably, to me, is suggesting is like the crowd is like pretty savage.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of in a frenzy about this. And the last thing I want to just add as a little addendum is I remember in A Movable Feast where he says, I was doing this. I knew I was writing really good stuff and nobody would buy my stuff. And I was like, I'm so far ahead of everybody. Maybe I should let them catch up a little bit. So, you know, they could buy my stuff. So even as a writer, as a young writer, he is thinking about audience. And even though he is doing something experimental and novel, he's like, you know, he wants a kind of a public, approval.
If it is kind of tending to the first answer, which is this is about bullfighting, but it also is about the way that the artist can be unfairly critiqued, the way that the audience can, as you said, I think be vicious or they can be savage. I'm wondering, you know, where we see it showing up in the Hemingway of 1923. You're suggesting that he's already feeling some of those kinds of bruisings early on.
Yeah. An awareness of this kind of, he's aware of the relationship between performer and audience. This, the amazing thing, and he never loses sight of this. I might be wrong about this, but I'm going to say it. Michael, tell me if I'm wrong. I think I'm thinking like Death in the Afternoon, The Sun Also Rises. He always knows how the crowd, it's like a symphony where he's aware of what the matador is doing, how the bull is behaving, and he often records how the crowd is responding. And the matadors are often aware of how the crowd is responding. Belmonte is sort of insolent about the crowd's disapproval. And so that's all part of the presentation that Hemingway is making.
Yeah, I'm even thinking to pull it out of bullfighting and gosh, out of Spain and how Hemingway writes about these years in Paris. It struck me, you're talking about performance and kind of some of the fraudulence or the posturing that can go into the creation of one's self-identity as artists. Well, he talks a lot about these kinds of individuals who are in these Paris cafes who are acting like artists and they're not artists. And he is. He wants to establish himself as an artist against these people kind of hanging around cafes.
There is a picture of him with the beret, though, I have to tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing against berets. I'm just saying, you know, he was young when he made these accusations.
Was that a photograph by Man Ray?
Yeah, that's right.
There's also a picture of Hemingway in the bullring, isn't he? He's in the amateurs before one of the big bullfights in Pamplona.
And he's in the mix, right?
I think he's right in. I think he has the cape.
He's right in there.
So, Mark, we've moved out of Spain. We've moved into Paris. Can we just keep getting more and more macro and maybe get even outside of the vignette itself? You know, it occurs to me that we've been talking a lot about in our time, and we might want to spend a few minutes discussing why that particular phrase, why Hemingway liked that phrase, why the book is, why the series of vignettes is titled In Our Time. What does it mean? What should we know about that title?
So In Our Time is from the Book of Common Prayer. And what I know about the Book of Common Prayer, I only know from my exploration as a Hemingway scholar, and I learned that in both the morning and evening prayers, the priest is to say, "Give peace in our time, O Lord." And the response to that is, "Because there is none other that fightest for us, but only thou, O God. So give peace in our time, O Lord, is really what the phrase comes from. And is Hemingway, so in our time is for Hemingway, it's such a juicy phrase with the notion of peace and prayer in mind, but also our time. So there's something generational about it, right? What resonates for you about that phrase?
So much about what you're saying already resonates. The fact that peace is there, the desire for it, the yearning for it, the fact that we have two vignettes already that are about the walking toward potential, possible, imminent death, and this vignette that is just depiction of violence in a bullring. It's desiring peace and it's violence filled. And yet, even in the title, peace is the thing that doesn't, is the word that doesn't show up, right? Right. It's one of the main words that seems to always be erased or held back. This is one of the many instances where Hemingway loved using religious texts, whether it's that, yeah. whether it's the King James Bible, the content of it, kind of the messaging of the title itself. There's something just so stylistically, rhythmically important about these kinds of passages that are pulled from these kinds of texts.
Yes, and applied to a secular scene. You wonder if to what extent the prayer in Hemingway's hands is desperate, or is it futile, or is it bitterly ironic, does it depend on the sketch that he's talking about? You're right that there were two for two in terms of violence, and this is a title that suggests peace. So, and also, I think when I say generational, it is something like we're going to be talking about war and peace in a new way and for a new generation and a new war and a new style to talk about it. So I think in our time would also suggest that project in 1924.
And the last thing I might say is it reminds me of the fact that in the little review that Exiles number in spring, where this vignette showed up before Hemingway ever kind of sets foot in Spain to see his first bullfight, he has not just this vignette, a series of a few other ones. He also has this little poem, which is not a good poem, but the title of that is, it's relevant to what we're talking about now. The title of that poem is, They All Made Peace. What is peace? And it's about the Lausanne Peace Conference. What is peace? I mean, that could be really one of the many subtitles too in our time.
That's a great connection with what we're talking about in mind, you know. So World War One obviously is a specific conflict to a specific historical time period that modernists responded to directly. Bullfighting, on the other hand, is something that is antique, traditional, and ancient. And I wonder if Hemingway is mining it for that kind of classic element, or if he is responding to bullfights aesthetically or morally, artistically, as a modernist. And that might also be something that we keep an eye on. How does he represent the bullfight as this volume goes along? I know that our time is limited. I wanted to say one thing, and this is, I'd love for this to be a feature, and that is to talk a little bit about the manuscript of In Our Time. And in Milt Cohen's Hemingway's Laboratory, he reprints a little bit of the manuscript for chapter 2. And there's one revision that I wanted to just bring out, and Michael, maybe get your reaction to it. So when in the moment where he says he got up like crazy drunk and tried to slug the men carrying him away, well, in the manuscript, instead of like crazy drunk, Hemingway originally wrote wild-eyed. And to the shift from wild-eyed to like crazy drunk, I think, to me, emphasizes what we were saying earlier about this being spoken. That something about Wild-Eyed is too written. It's too writerly. It's not something Mike Strader would have said in a hurried account of the story. It's something that Hemingway would have written in a cafe to capture the scene. But I don't know. So in other words, it's almost like it was too good. So he peeled it back to Like Crazy Drunk, which seems to be a more primitive description.
You normally think with revision, yeah, you're going for the best possible word. And maybe this is the best possible word or phrase, but it's the best because it actually doesn't sound like you've carefully articulated it. It doesn't sound like it's been, like you've revised it, you've refined it, you've polished it.
It's unrefined.
Can't have
yeah,
that. It's- yeah. Of course, what are we saying? The revision is better than the draft. But it's better because even the word like there, he got up like crazy drunk. That small word. How many times do we put these kinds of fillers into what we say? That also suggests the fact that maybe he's overheard it, but certainly it sounds like it's being spoken.
Yeah. You know, Michael, we were saying, I think this word came out way more than I expected in our discussion of chapter one, but it also occurs to me that it's a courageous artistic decision to be so raw and to be unrefined as a young writer, or to appear unrefined when you're actually are refining it, to me is artistically courageous to do something like that. And I don't know, maybe that resonates, the kid resonates with Hemingway, and, you know, will the audience appreciate it or will it hoot and holler? Who knows? Who cares? This is how he's going to do it.
It is courageous. And when you have other writers, Wyndham Lewis and others, who are going to be caricaturing Hemingway as the dumb ox, right?
Yeah. And also you're opening yourself up to possible misinterpretation because you're leaving certain things ambiguous instead of perfectly explained. Mm-hmm. I think you can make the argument that there can be variant readings in chapter one and chapter two. Chapter two, we don't know if it ends in raucous approval or a riot or some chaotic mixture of those two, or if it's just noise at the end. And Hemingway could have been way more specific about what's going on in that scene.
One of the moments, I don't even know if we mentioned it, but even when the kid comes out, the kid came out and had to kill five bulls. And there's that little explanation, because mm-hmm. you can't have more than three. And here's the moment. And the last bull, he was so tired, he couldn't get the sword in. So there are a lot of he's going on there.
Yeah, right.
And is... can he not get the sword in because he, the matador, the kid, right, is tired? Is it because he, the bull, is tired? Because that's the last thing that's being referred to. The last bull, he was so tired, he couldn't get the sword in. There, even in that moment, it might be hard to visualize, understand what's actually happening.
It's a mess. The pronouns are an absolute mess in this, mm-hmm. in this piece. And it's probably the type of mess that we all make when we tell those kinds of stories.
I imagine it's the mess that could be made if after this episode, we transcribe parts of it.
Certainly my parts. Absolutely. Yeah.
the whole point is we talk like this, and to make it authentic, we have to have that messiness.
And, we are wild-eyed also as we're doing this. So, Michael, we started in France, we moved to Spain, and then chapter three, guess where we're going? We're going to Greece.
Oh, my passport is going to be so filled.
That's where Hemingway's taking us, the first three. So I look forward to it, Michael.
Thanks, Mark.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold. So if you have someone in your life who loves books and Hemingway, buy a copy or two, and spread the joy. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one, truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This show is supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.
Chiamano bionda, a bionda io non sono.